stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension of 1 centimeter is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and welcome to Sharing Science Radio. We're broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. We grab science and scientists and stick them on the airwaves. Here you hear about how science is done, who's doing it, what it's telling us, and why it matters. I'm your host, Alan Manning, and with me today is Sam Livingston.
Hey guys.
Today we're talking about the science of cancer. In our Chronicles of Science section, Sam's talking about what is cancer and how do we treat it. Today, we're talking about the science of cancer. In our Chronicles of Science section, Sam's telling us what is cancer and how do we treat it, and Emil Lundberg interviews UBC professor Carolyn Gauthe about cancer prevention. Then we're going to wrap it up with Shop Talk, where no topic is off limits. But first, what exactly is cancer? It's been estimated that 50% or 66%, depending on where you live, of people during their lifetimes will get cancer. And it's a word that's quite scary, but it's not actually one disease. Now, if I walk up to you and say, hey, I got an infection, you're probably going to say, well, what infection do you have? You know, is it something nefarious like Ebola or is it just the common cold? Same thing goes with cancer. Cancer is basically uncontrolled growth of certain cells in your body. But that uncontrolled growth can be due to many different reasons. A cancer cell is one that has its genome screwed up somehow. Its blueprints are all off, and the proper instructions that control how that cell grows and divides are either ignored or they're just completely wrong. And most people know this. We know that cancer is caused by mutations of the genome. But what's interesting is that it's more than one mutation. Now, you can have a mutation in your genome that might not even cause any problems in a cell at all. The cell might correct itself, or it just might not cause any issues at all. You might also have a mutation in your cell that causes abnormal growth. You know, the cell grows and divides faster than the cells around it. But that's not cancer. That might be hyperplasia, where there's too many cells. You might get a precancerous polyp, but that is still not cancer. Things get really nefarious when cells get even more mutations that allow them to recruit a blood supply and that allows them to travel where cells are not supposed to go. Generally, cells stay put, but when cells start dividing uncontrollably and traveling throughout the body, that's metastasis, and that's the dangerous part of cancer. Okay, so that's kind of a brief rundown of what cancer is. Now, let's move over to Sam, and he's going to tell us how do we treat cancer now, and how might we treat cancer in the future?
The term cancer is an umbrella term that's used to describe uncontrolled growth and division of cells that are normally not supposed to. The key word here is uncontrolled. Under ideal conditions, your body begins with stem cells that do not have a specific function, unlike red blood cells or skin cells. Stem cells are the parents of these cells, and whenever your body needs more red blood or skin cells, it calls on the stem cells to divide in a controlled manner to produce a bunch of daughter cells, and those later become your functioning red blood or skin cells. But due to environmental cues or mutations to these stem cells over time, the controlled division can change. Maybe the gene that's responsible for saying, hey, stem cell, divide 3 times in 3 days. It gets mutated and instead becomes a message to the stem cell saying, holy crap, divide as fast as possible forever! Even though your body does not need all those extra cells. This is one of the several characteristics of tumor growth, and we need to find a way to stop it. We hear a lot about chemotherapy drugs, how they're sometimes very effective at ridding the body of cancer, but also very harmful to the normal healthy tissues. Traditional chemotherapy drugs are particularly prone to this, because they aren't able to discriminate between tumor cells that divide uncontrollably and really quickly, versus your normal healthy cells that may also be dividing quickly, but in a very controlled manner. This results in a suppressed immune system, hair that falls out, and sometimes sexual impotence. The stem cells found in the male reproductive system are constantly undergoing division, producing nearly 200 to 300 million new sperm cells per day. Like a broad-spectrum antibiotic, traditional chemotherapy drugs try to kill anything and everything it can, sometimes at the cost of healthy cells and tissues. So to combat this, targeted chemotherapy approaches are currently being developed. These are very specific molecules and antibodies that are designed to interrupt other very specific molecules, and theoretically, molecules that are exclusively being used by cancer cells. However, not all cancer cells are the same, or utilize the same mutations or environmental cues to divide so uncontrollably. This is where we get into an area called personalized pharmacogenomics, and it's in a really exciting field that is being researched locally at the BC Cancer Agency, as well as worldwide. Basically, it's just an individual type of cancer treatment for your particular type of cancer, and this can vary so widely between every single individual on Earth. It aims to sequence the DNA in your healthy cells, compare it to the DNA in your cancer cells, and then determine what mechanism of cancer development actually occurred in your body, and then treating it with an equally specific molecule that stops only those cancer cells and not your hair-producing, immune system, or reproductive system.
Nothing like bringing up sperm cells to make sure I'm paying attention, eh, Sam? Okay, well, let's move now to an interview by Emil Lundberg of Carolyn Gote, who is a professor at the UBC School of Population and Public Health.
Today, I'm at the School of Population and Public Health here at UBC, and with me, I have Professor Carolyn Gote. Would you mind giving our listeners a brief introduction about who you are and what you're working on?
I'm a professor in the School of Population and Public Health here at the University of British Columbia. I also hold a position called the Chair in Cancer Primary Prevention. And so that kind of gives you an idea where I spend most of my time, and that is looking at ways of preventing cancer research programs designed to help us move in that direction.
So today's topic is cancer prevention. With your help, we're going to dig a little deeper into this field. Cancer prevention is definitely a hot topic among all people. I mean, everyone wants to limit their risks of getting cancer. We all know about the typical risk factors such as smoking, alcohol, tanning, and exposure to ionizing radiation. Is there any of these risk factors that you feel is usually overlooked in media and in public, or is the one that don't get enough attention that maybe should be given more attention?
Well, you've named a lot of the major risk factors, but not all of them. I'll get to that in a second. But in terms of the one that has the most impact, it's definitely tobacco exposure. And I think the attention these days sometimes has shifted from tobacco with the idea, well, not as many people are smoking as used to be, which is absolutely true. But so we don't have to worry about that anymore. But the fact is we still do have to worry about it. We still have almost 1 in 5 people who are still smoking here in Canada. And it seems to be on the rise in certain subgroups, such as younger people like yourself, and certain population subgroups like people who live on First Nations in rural areas. So that battle isn't over. And really, tobacco exposure, either directly through smoking or indirectly through exposure to secondhand smoke in the air, has the biggest single influence on cancer rates. So that one deserves all the attention that we want to give it. The other things that you talked about, though, are important as well. But one thing you didn't mention is being overweight or obese. And we found that actually carrying extra weight is a significant contributor to a lot of cancer types. Another factor that you might want to consider is physical activity, because increasingly we find that being physically active has an independent positive protective effect on not getting cancer. So those are two in the list I think you didn't mention that really do deserve attention. But other things you talked about, healthy diet, making sure that you have enough fruits and vegetables, avoiding excess sun exposure, avoiding unnecessary ionizing radiation from other sources. Alcohol is another factor that you mentioned. You're absolutely right. It is linked with cancer. So those are among the biggest risk factors. We're always learning about more, though. I mean, that's the thing. And so one of my projects right now is looking at the role of sleep, either short sleep, disrupted sleep, as a promoter of cancer. So that's sort of a new risk factor. There's good evidence in both animals and in certain subcategories of human beings, particularly people who work night shifts, that show that sleep has something to do with cancer rates. The exciting thing about doing this kind of work is that we're learning things all the time. We're learning new things, new risk factors, and better ways of controlling cancer.
Could you expand on which type of cancer would be related to sleep particularly?
Well, we found that sleep in shift workers is well established as a risk factor for breast cancer. So that is the one that we have the firmest evidence about. There's certainly suggestive evidence for prostate cancer and colon cancer as well related to sleep deficits. So it may be, we don't know all the mechanisms, we're just figuring that out. It certainly has a biological effect on the brain. Melatonin is implicated for sure. But there's a pretty, the risk of night shift work for breast cancer is a carcinogen that's as high as exposure to some environmental carcinogens. So it is a strong risk factor that we need to take into consideration.
So earlier this year, there was a study published in Science titled Variation in Cancer Risk Among Tissues Can Be Explained by the Number of Stem Cell Divisions, which the basic idea, if understood correctly, is that many types of cancer can be explained by the number of stem cell divisions, that cancer, and then it's a numbers game, they argue there, in some cancers. Could you enlighten our listeners a little bit more about how that would work and the phenomena about that?
Well, to just say a little bit more about that study. So what that study looked at was a particular kind of cell, stem cells, and how many divisions they have and how that's related to different cancer rates. It was performed by basic scientists, including some who are very eminent in the field of stem cells. And it's clear that cell division is at the root of cancer. It is a cellular disease. You've got mistakes that the cells are making. They aren't controlled properly. They may change their form and mutate. And so that is what cancer is about. So it's very exciting in that regard. And very well known that cell divisions are related to the probability of cancer. That's one reason why, partially anyway, people get more cancer when they get older. There's more cell divisions over the course of their lifetime, more chances for mistakes to be made. And so I'd say that's been known for a long time, actually. What was interesting about this study was that they looked at cell divisions in adjacent tissues, so let's say different parts of the intestines, and found that cancer rates seem to be correlated with the number of cell divisions in different parts of similar organs. And so that's interesting because we know the organs would be possibly affected by the same environmental exposures and everything else. So if you see differences, then it does seem to be something biological. So there's an interesting twist there, and it was certainly intriguing to look at. The challenge with the article, though, was that it went well, well beyond its data of looking at cell divisions in a laboratory and extended this to all of human cancers and, in fact, extended the idea that, yeah, there's a higher likelihood here to say that actually cancer is largely due to chance. And that was an inference that really wasn't well justified. And some of the evidence that these folks extended to were epidemiologically based kinds of findings about which cancers are more and less prevalent. So based on their cell divisions, they said, well, these cancers are ones that are likely to be due to chance. They aren't going to have any kind of an environmental exposure, and these ones might. And among the ones they said, for example, that are very unlikely to be due but to environmental exposures are all due to chance was malignant melanoma. Now, that's a skin cancer that is very deadly. It's of all the skin cancers, it's the one that is most likely to kill you. And it is almost completely explained by exposure to sunlight. There were other things like that in their findings. So they kind of had something that was neat, and then they extended it way too far. And the journal Science, wonderful journal, one of the best around, ran with it and made a lot of headlines and made a lot of us who looked at it a little bit dispassionately saying, what's going on here? Yeah, this is neat. This is an interesting hypothesis, needs to be studied in the future. But human beings aren't cells in a laboratory. Stem cells in human beings don't just divide all by themselves in a dish. We're constantly be exposed to all kinds of things that affect whether we may get cancer, whether we stop cancer in its tracks. And the data that they're extending it to just don't make sense. We know what happens with, for example, melanoma and some of the other cancers that they identified. They aren't due to chance. We can explain them by a lot of very well-defined exposures. So that was the controversy. And when we read that article, a number of us, my colleagues at the BC Cancer Agency and here at the School of Population Public Health, and we said, like, we don't think this is right. So we wrote a letter explaining our perspective and saying, like, this is interesting, but they've gone beyond their data here. And the letter was published and actually got quite a lot of press on its own, which was nice. And we were joined by other people around the world who also found a lot of limitations in that study. So any study has limitations. And if it makes us think and it makes us critically examine what's ahead of us, that's a good thing to do. But some cancer is due to chance. I'm not going to disagree with that. Some is. And we don't know how to prevent every kind of cancer. But some we know have a pretty good idea. And so we don't want to generalize to all cancers on the basis of evidence that really doesn't support that.
What I remember is that I read about this article, both in Nature and also in everyday newspapers that published this story. And I see a problem when scientists state to have the truth about how things are going, and the general public will, of course, trust them when they publish these types of results. And then maybe a lot of people will say, like, hey, this is the truth, and they don't really see the follow-ups. Have you noticed any ways that are particularly effective of communicating scientific research, particularly then in cancer prevention, to the general public? Which ways work and which ways do not work to communicate new scientific evidence in cancer prevention?
Well, I think journalists can be allies in this effort. Here you are. You're talking to me, and you're being an ally. But we have some excellent science reporters in Canada who really know not to hype out something and to present something in a balanced manner. So I think there are some very responsible journalists who are helping us to tell our message. I think being able to talk clearly, to not get into technicalities when that isn't warranted because of the audience's understanding of that information, to try to demystify science and put it in words that people understand is very helpful. A lot of times I find giving examples or anecdotes is a good way to get a message across, because we learn by cognition and what's in our mind. We also learn by what's in our heart. So if you can have some emotional component to it, sometimes that helps to make a story stick. One thing I think we have to constantly tell folks is that any one study is only any one study. That's one of the biggest challenges that I see. Something gets picked up in the newspaper or the radio or TV because it's new and different. And we all want things that are new and different. We want progress. But we have to remember that any one study is only one study, and it has to be replicated. It has to be extended. If it's something that's been done based on, let's say, mice or rats, well, that's great. But that may or may not be something that we should be using to take care of our kids, let's say, because they aren't little mice. And so you kind of have to take a critical eye as a reader and say, this is neat, but I think I've got to wait a couple of years until I see if it actually happens with humans or whether other scientists in the world also find the same thing. So that kind of calming down a little bit and not jumping the first time you see something new is something I think we all have to remember, because we're all looking for answers. We'd love to have the answers, but usually it's not that easy.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, and people are always grasping for easy truths, and that's because it's easy to access. And just came to think of, there's definitely, I can see a lot of research being done that these are risk factors for this and this type of cancer, but also these are the means of reducing your risks of getting cancer. Which of those messages do you prefer giving to the public, and which would be, how do you see these being used differently? I mean, say that tobacco smoking will increase your risks of cancer, or exercising will reduce your risks of cancer. How should those two be communicated to be received the best way by the public?
Yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I'm a psychologist by training, and that's the kind of a study that a social psychologist, like the way I was trained, would be looking at to see whether you have a positive or a negative way of framing something and whether it makes a difference. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. And with the physical activity one, you could say sedentary behavior, so that means sitting around, not moving much, increases your risk. So you can always take a protective risk or a bad risk and flip them the other way. So you pretty well, I think you've got to mix messages up, to be honest. I don't think there's always one way that's better than another. People get tired of hearing messages if they're always the same way. You know, don't eat so much, get out and run. Maybe it should be, eat more or good things and don't sit around as much. So you can kind of twist it around and I think keep things fresh, which is probably a better way to keep people interested and motivated.
So if you go back to the bigger picture here, what do you see are the biggest challenges today in terms of cancer prevention? Which are the challenges that we face today in society, and which are the most important questions that you feel that needs to be brought up to light today in society?
Well, that's a big question. I think one of the biggest challenges I face when I talk to the public is that people don't necessarily believe that cancer is preventable. So they've bought into that cell stuff, and their idea is, well, it's all a matter of my family history, genetics, I'm either, born with the tendency to get it or not, and they don't really understand that they can do a whole lot to modify their risk status. And I'm not denying that heredity can make a huge difference, and we're learning more about that all the time. But we know about 50% of cancers can be prevented, and when I tell people that, they're usually very surprised. So that's a barrier to get over the fact that, yeah, you can do something about it. You can't prevent everything, and you might still get cancer even if you do everything right. So it is unfortunately not a recipe for complete success, but boy, you can make a difference in your life and take control over it. So I think that is one of the biggest challenges. Another challenge is that a lot of changes that people could make to live healthier lives aren't really all about their own volition. So we can point fingers, you should eat more, you should get out more, but you may not be able to afford food that's healthier. You may be like me, tied to your desk. And so I think we have to create environments that are going to support healthy behavior. So if we want people to eat healthy food, then we have to have pricing structures that allow people to afford it. If we want people to get out and about, then we have to give them breaks. Maybe standing desks are a good thing. There are things in the environment that aren't all about the individual. So it's an environment really that supports those behaviors. And we don't always have healthy environments, and think of going outside of blaming individuals and really looking at the social structure a little bit more broadly. So I think those are among the challenges that we have in moving forward.
I think it's time for us to start to wrap up this interview now. Thank you very much. This was all from the Sharing Science Radio Show today here from the School of Public Health with Carolyn Gotti. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much. It was fun.
Thanks, Emil. And thanks to Professor Carolyn Gotti. All right, we're going to have a quick break. Don't go away. There's more science coming at you.
When Shanna Larson was a little girl, she already had artistic talent, and it was clear that she would be quite an athlete. But Shan always knew what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to teach. Shan was only 24 years old when she lost her life to breast cancer, and now it's her spirit that will teach us. Teach us to know our risk. For more information, visit teamshan.ca. Breast cancer, not just a disease of older women.
Welcome back to UBC Sharing Science. I'm Al Manning, and with me is Sam Livingston. Today we're talking about the science of cancer. Up next is our Shop Talk session, where Sam and I geek out and talk about what we've just heard. I want to start off, Sam, by talking a little bit about the study that Emil and Carolyn were referencing. So just to remind you, this was a study that essentially looked at how much of a cancer risk is due to environmental factors and how much of it is due to chance.
Mm-hmm. Random chance.
Random chance. Good old random chance. And Professor Gotti was saying how there was actually a lot of criticism of this study. She actually was one of the authors on a letter that was sort of picking apart the methods. So I thought it'd be kind of interesting to talk about what some of the issues were that certain people found with this study. And this study is called A Variation in Cancer Risk Among Tissues Can Be Explained by the Number of Stem Cell Divisions. And it's by Tomasetti and Vogelstein, and it was published in Science Magazine, January 2015. Now, just to let you know, there are sort of two top-tier journals. One of them is called Nature Magazine. The other one is called Science Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you publish a paper in Science, that's a pretty big deal. Same goes with Nature.
Yeah, I think between the two of them, they cover every single field of science, and they take only the best or the most monumental papers that actually contribute to the field of study, which is really cool and really exciting. So it's kind of sad when you talk to someone like Dr. Carolyn Gauthier and she has criticisms about the way that the journal is published or a paper that it published.
Right. Well, you know, kind of sad, but also good because that's what science is all about. Yeah. And what's interesting is if you look in the later issues of Science Magazine, it's a little bit confusing. I think they should change their title because, you know, Science Magazine, that sounds, I don't know.
Yeah, it makes it sound like it's the New Yorker. Or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they do publish a lot of letters critiquing the study. Anyway, so basically what these people looked at was different tissue types in different organs in the body. Now, we talked about how cancer can occur in lots of places in the body. It can occur in different organs, and they occur at a different rate in different organs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, lung cancer is quite common, but other cancers will be more rare. And they looked at, in each organ, how much does the average cell divide? So if you take, let's say someone who's 30 years old, and we look at all their different organs, and we look at each cell and say, okay, how many generations removed from the initial cell is this? And you would find that they replicate at different rates. And then you can look at, okay, what is the chance of getting cancer in that organ? And that's known from certain numbers. And then you can basically draw a graph that looks at the number of cell divisions versus the chance of getting cancer in that organ.
Mm-hmm.
And you can draw, you know, you've got a bunch of data points, you draw a line through it, and you say, oh, there's a great correlation, therefore this must be true. Now, there's a lot of controversy over this for a number of reasons. Now, I just want to point out one reason in particular. One critique was that there's a lot of variation among cells in each tissue. You'll find some cells that are quite young, and you'll find some cells that are quite old that have been many generations removed. So that was one major critique. And it was also interesting that, and Professor Gauthier pointed this out, that, you know, depending on where you get your rates from, you could actually massage the data in a certain way. You know, how do we know that cancer occurs in some organs at a specific rate?
So to put a biological context on what we've been talking about, every single time a stem cell divides, it's going to acquire 60 new mutations. So when that one cell becomes two cells, those two cells each have 60 new random mutations that are unlike what was in the previous stem cell.
So errors in the blueprint.
Errors in the blueprint. And the thing is that, as Alan mentioned earlier,
all right, my name is Anita B, and this is my show. It's called Sam Squanch's Hideaway. And this cancer talk, which is from the show Ahead of Mine, is going to be on for about another 3 or so minutes, and I'm really enjoying it. I could cut it off, but I actually teach grade 9 science. Like, I teach grade 9 science, so I'm like Ms. Nye, the science guy. and my point here is it's quite good. I'm enjoying all this cell talk and cancer and stuff. So just hang tight, folks. In about 3 minutes, my show, Sam Squanch's Hideaway, will be on, which is where Canadian music is played until 8 o'clock. But let's keep listening to this very rousing discussion on cancer, cell reproduction, and stem cells.
Ooh. There's only sections of your genome that are of interest. So 1% of your DNA is actually functional genes that are going to result in some type of product in the end. Whereas there's 99% of your DNA that's unpopularly referred to as junk DNA. And they don't actually have they're not considered genes. So if you get a mutation that's outside of your genes, it's going to be less detrimental, theoretically, than a mutation that's within one of your genes. But if a stem cell undergoes many, many, many replications, that's 60 new mutations every single time it divides. And eventually, one of those mutations will land in a gene. And maybe that gene is really important for its cell cycle.
Right, right. But there's also the body has also built in defenses to detect these mutations and correct them.
Absolutely, yeah. There's specific DNA repair mechanisms, and these proteins are going to come in, and they might recognize one of these new 60 mutations that have occurred through division, and it goes back, and it's able to self-check and repair whatever mutation actually just happened. So if one single base in your DNA changed, it's able to revert it back to the original.
Okay.
But what about the gene for the DNA repair protein? Because all proteins come from a DNA segment, because that's the blueprint. So if we have a mutation that occurs on our repair mechanism, then all of a sudden our entire repair mechanism is going to be gone, and we're never going to be able to fact check any of our mutations anymore. And that increases the number of possible mutations in your cell.
Okay. Now, I imagine there are multiple repair mechanisms.
Yeah, very robust systems. Right. There are multiple ones.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's also mechanisms that repair your DNA like we're talking about. There's other mechanisms that will basically just kill the cell if it detects that it's going out of control.
Apoptosis.
Apoptosis. That means programmed cell death.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a controlled death of the cell.
Right.
It's like your body recognizes that it's going to be the plague. It is going to be cancer. So it's going to shut it off.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's also going on. Actually, there's an interesting way of sort of talking about what your genes do. You know, some genes that describe your programmed cell death, this apoptosis, are kind of like the brake pedal, you know? Mm-hmm. Something goes wrong, you know, oh no, we can jam on the brake.
Yeah, and slow it down.
Slow it down. And there's other genes that control replication that are kind of like the gas pedal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Let's speed things up. So when you have cancer, you have to have multiple mutations. I've heard numbers between 3 and 20 mutations in order to have full-blown metastatic cancer.
Yeah.
And of course, that totally depends on where the mutations are.
Absolutely.
And if there's a genetic predisposition. But, you know, you have to have the gas pedal crammed down, stuck on, and this brake pedal not functioning, you know?
I love these analogies.
Yeah.
You should see Alan in the studio. He's got his legs up in the air, and he's stomping on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when both of them are screwed up, I'm going to run into the wall.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you have to have more than one mutation. All right, we better wrap it up there. I've been your host, Alan Manning, and with me today was Sam Livingston.
Thanks for stopping in, everyone.
We also heard an interview by Emil Lungbird of Professor Carolyn Gote. You've been listening to UBC Sharing Science. Stay tuned. Up next is Sam Squanch's Hideaway.